This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello and welcome to The Morning Run on BFM 89.9, the business station. 6 o'clock on Monday, the 13th of June. Happy Monday to you. Had a good weekend, guys?
Absolutely. It was fabulous, full of nothing in particular, which is the way I like it.
Actually, it was a fun weekend for me because, you know, you spend time with the family and it's fasting month. So I get to spend time with some of the extended family.
That's the time to catch up.
And it's just the right amount of dose of family. I can't, you know, be with them the whole time.
I was going to ask you, this was just like a kind of one of those rose-tinted visions of family. Because it sounds like hard work.
It is, actually.
Okay, because there's a sweet spot, right?
Yeah, it's
between,
a sweet
spot. Too much family and just too little.
So, in a very rare moment of embrace, I actually embrace Monday. And this has been one of those longest of time.
I actually look forward to Monday. That's great. I'm Melissa Idris. That was Sharad Kutin and Ibrahim Sani you just heard there. Do let us keep you company for the next 4 hours because we have a great show lined up for you. This is, of course, the last week of campaigning for the by-elections in Kuala Kangsar and Sungai Besar before voters go to the polls on Saturday. So we're putting together a breakfast grill that will bring together a panel of political analysts for an in-depth discussion because analysts are really watching the outcome of the polls closely as it will have a huge bearing on coalition politics nationally.
Yeah, I think there's also, you know, this oft-quoted phrase along with the by-elections that it's a bellwether of what is coming up and people are looking at GE14. But, the question is, you know, a week is a long time in politics. I wonder what it would be to speculate about the results that will come out on Saturday for an election that's only due in 2018, but there's heavy speculation that it will be called next year.
Yeah, and I think a lot of speculation tends to focus with fourth quarter of next year. So that would mean that we would have about 12 to 15 months of preparation towards the general elections. And a lot of political parties will see this as a way to gauge, public sentiment towards many of these political parties. So I guess it is a bellwether of an election.
And basically, you want to see who's working with whom, right? And who's on whose side as well. So
or who's not working with who?
Yeah, exactly.
That's more likely than not.
Exactly. So we're going to bring Tricia Yeo, the Chief Operations Officer of the think tank Ideas, on the Breakfast Grill. And joining her will be Bridget Welsh, Professor of Political Science at IPAC University in Turkey. She's also a longtime observer of Malaysian politics. So an in-depth discussion there with Sharad Kutin on the Breakfast Grill today, 8:05 a.m. And after the grill, we're going to be focusing on child labour because yesterday was World Day Against Child Labour. So we're going to take a look at the state of child labour in the Asian Pacific region, as well as the risks of exploitation of stateless children. And this year's theme for World Day Against Child Labour is child labour in the global supply chain. So we're definitely going to be taking a closer look at that on Current Affairs today, 8:35 a.m. Also happening on the show on Pressing Matters, we speak to Bernd Pickert, a journalist from Die Tageszeitung, or better known as TAZ, which is a German newspaper, one of the five daily newspapers distributed nationwide.
Yeah, and in fact, you know, if you hear the sound of the name and you don't know German, you might think this was like some hefty,
it sounds really serious.
And all does Taz Zeitung means is the daily paper. It literally the daily paper.
So we'll be covering the issue of the migrant crisis in Germany and also the rise of the far right movement in Europe as well. So I guess no one better to speak to this other than Bernd Pickert because he covers these issues extensively.
And also his paper is left-leaning, so they focus on a lot of liberal issues. And I think it's interesting to see how they view the coverage of the migrant crisis, perhaps the gaps in reporting, and also what seems to be in recent years the rise of the far right, not just in Germany, but across Europe. You see that in France, in the UK with UKIP, and so on. So we'll be discussing more on that on Pressing Matters with Bernd Pickett from the German newspaper Taz. Okay, it's 5 minutes past 6 o'clock. Let's take a look at some late-breaking news. There was a shooting, a mass shooting in Orlando. 50 people are now known to have died following the shooting in the gay nightclub in Orlando, Florida. The gunman has now been identified as Omar Mateen. And he was killed after taking hostages at this club called Pulse.
Right. So a lot of attention has been paid to his origins. He's of Afghan origin, but I believe he was born in the U.S. in 1986. So it's just that his parents were from Afghanistan. Of course, for those who want to continually point to, you know, some militant tendency in the Islamic population in America and in the Islamophobic rhetoric, they would point to that. Though I believe that's already information come out from news that's come out about his ex-wife. His ex-wife's come out to say that he was a wife beater, that he enjoyed going to the gym and wasn't particularly religious.
Yeah, and
so there might be something in the gym bunny.
I suppose, but Occupy Democrats. It's a satire or closest satire kind of outlet for the Democratic Party. They posted something quite interesting on their Instagram handle. They said that there has been 8. Shootings, mass shootings in Canada for the past 20 years. But in US, there has been 7 since Monday. So that
no,
is
actually, the... In fact, the stats are staggering. It's a mass shooting a day.
Yeah, so hence the 7th shooting since Monday. Get it?
Yeah.
And, you know, this is the whole point of the whole discussion of mass shooting, whether it's Orlando, whether or not it's in Kentucky or anywhere else. Will Maher argued over the weekend, making Trump the president, it's like giving a toddler a gun. Wait a minute, we do that too. So that is the bigger question right now. Is US ready to give up their gun control
Well,
laws?
You know, it's a lot wider of a discussion than just that. You know, it's built into the Constitution. It's not something Americans can readily accept. I mean, they're both sides of the argument. But for this specific shooting, this is in fact the worst mass shooting in the history of the US.
In terms of casualties.
In terms of casualties. We're talking about 50 casualties, whereas...
50 dead,
about 50 odd also injured. If you look at the, I believe, was it the Virginia Tech mass shooting was about 30-something
and Sandy Hook's
victims. Yeah, that's right.
Also.
We discussed this. It's like some sort of a very sick, macabre kind of, score line. 50 there, 30 here, 20 there. I think, yes, Constitution is baked into ensuring each and every single American their right to own or bear arms. But I think there's also a part where the Constitution allows for amendments to happen. It's very difficult to do. I agree with you, Melissa, but amendments have happened before. The question is, how long will American society face this fact that they need to change their laws?
Again, it's an American conversation. I mean, there's violence around the world and, you know, things that are of this proportion in many parts of the world that don't even rate a blip in the media scape, right? Bombings in Baghdad just recently and such. But I think at the end of the day, listening into the conversation that Americans are having about their right to bear arms and then the policy implications, what does it mean, right? You have a right to bear arms, but then should everybody be allowed and, you know, what kind of checks and balances? I think Michael Moore's documentary, Bowling for Columbine, did exactly that in comparing Canada. So, you know, he kind of walks over to Canada and says, well, in this country, it's so different. But I think that's an ongoing conversation. It's interesting to listen into. It sounds agonizing because every time something like Sandy Hook's happened,
so
where
this
it was
conversation
just
has been going on for over 200 years, and now the stats is one mass shooting per day. So that's the conversation is still ongoing.
Well, you know, 200 years. years ago, they didn't have the kind of weaponry that's now, you know, that Americans, ordinary citizens can legally own, right? These semi-automatic rifles and stuff. I mean, you know.
Yeah, I mean, you can get a home-delivered semi-automatic rifle
from
Walmart. I believe
that was one of the policy avenues that President Obama was looking at, rather than to amend the Constitution as the right to bear arms, but to look at gun control in a way of registering, making it more difficult to purchase weapons without proper registration, etc.
So difficult is the issue. Obama managed to carve out two things during his presidency. One is the TPPA, the other one is Obamacare. But he can't get the gun control issue off the ground because it's very, very difficult to navigate.
Okay, well, we will keep you abreast as to any further developments from the Orlando shooting in the news bulletins at the every half an hour in the morning. So you'll stay tuned for that, please. But also other news. Over the weekend, there was some a kerfuffle that broke out over Euro 2016. So UEFA has now threatened to disqualify England and Russia from Euro 2016 if there's any further violence by fans. So it has begun disciplinary proceedings against Russia, but not England. And this was after footage showed Russian fans rushed at England supporters after Saturday's England-Russia game.
Yeah, and so I watched that game. And after the English scored the goal, Russian fans actually jumped over the fence and chased after the English fans. And this included, you know, women and children as well, as basically anyone on the English side of the stand.
So now that UEFA has threatened disciplinary action, right, threatened to disqualify England and Russia, is that enough to get fans to toe the line, to behave?
You know, back in the World Cup in 1998, the same thing happened. And it didn't stop violence then, so I doubt it will stop violence now.
Okay, all right. Well, let's find out more. If, in fact, England and Russia will be disqualified. But over the weekend, the former political secretary to Tun Abdul Razak, Tan Sri Abdullah Ahmad, or better known as Dollah Kok Lanas, he passed away at a private hospital on Saturday at the age of 83 and believed to have been, due to cancer.
Yeah, and so his remains have been sent to Kelantan, Kuala Lumpur, Kelantan, for burial there.
Yeah, you know, I had the pleasure of interviewing the man many years ago. I mean, I think it's at least 15 years ago at his home when I was doing an article on think tanks in Malaysia. And I was looking at some informal think tanks that existed, you know, just after or during the early 70s. And I spoke to him because he was seen as a gatekeeper for the Razak administration, and it was especially true during the NOC years. Remember, after the 69, the events of May 13, 1969, Parliament was suspended. We were no longer a democracy, because the question is, have we continued to be a democracy since then? But never mind. During that period, the NOC, the National Operations Council, he was seen as a gatekeeper, and
he didn't get much support, and he wasn't well liked within the UMNO ranks, let alone the opposition ranks.
Really? Yeah. Oh, you look at the front page of Utusan today. They say, you know, they credit him as, you know, his passing.
Well,
as
he
a
passed
big,
away, so I guess the
big
threat
loss.
Is no more there. But when he was alive, you know, King Gaz, for instance, the former Home Secretary, actually accused him of, you know, of many things.
But that was part of the factional fighting in UMNO, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, many people were targeted at that period. Samad Said, not Samad Said.
Shahri Samad.
No, I'm thinking of the NST editor whose name, Samad.
Oh, Noraina Samad's dad.
Yeah,
of course.
You know, was also taken for many, many years under the Internal Security Act. So was, Dollah Kok Lanas. Also collateral damage in people like Syed Hussein Ali, who kind of did a double stint. He was drawn into the conspiracy that was kind of scripted around Dollah Kok Lanas' arrest and detention. So, yeah, I mean, you know, I don't think he was disliked. It's just that he was part of the ongoing factional fighting in UMNO,
Yeah. But his passing does mark the end of an era of the Razak administration, because he was one of those last individuals that were connected with the statesman.
Political secretary of Tun Abdul Razak, right? I think we also interviewed him on current affairs back in 2011 as part of our Merdeka series. Here, you can catch that podcast at our website. And very interesting because he talks about his experiences during the May 13th riot, what he was doing, what he saw, you know, that kind of the entire experience of that. And we recorded that as part of our oral histories project.
Yeah. I mean, what's interesting about this generation who are in the 80s now is that, you know, they came out of the war years, went to university in the 50s, and really were part of that generation that were going to take the reins of government in a post-colonial, you know, an independence phase of the nation. So in many ways, a lot of the problems we have today, we can lay firmly at their feet, I think, you know, and blame them for much of our woes. Abdul Ahmad made a very famous speech at the Institute of Southeast Asian Studies in Singapore in 1986, talking about the social contract. In fact, he made that expression, you know, gave it a currency that it never had before. And he spoke about, you know, the racial character of the country. And so he made a plug for, I mean, an intellectual argument, if you like, for majoritarian rule. And I think he's going to go down, and that, I think, is going to be one of his lasting legacies.
6:15 now. We'll be back with Smart Homes after this. BFM 89.9. Good morning. I hope you're all started up. It's 6:20. This is Monday morning, the 13th of June. I'm Melissa Idris with Sharad Kutan and Ibrahim Sani. Now, we're talking about smart homes this morning. Smart homes meaning all your devices and appliances are connected, so they talk to each other. So, for instance, the coffee maker that turns on when your alarm clock rings, lighting and blinds that adjust time of day, and your refrigerator, for instance, that sends an alert to your local grocery, your local supermarket to say you've run out of milk. So all that connected devices leading to smart homes or smarter homes. But so far, apparently, according to The Economist, consumers have largely been resistant to making their homes smart. Why do you think that is, Sharad?
Well, there might be all kinds of things. Like, okay, so one of the examples would be using a robot to clean your home or using a person, right? And I don't know what the costs of robots are. And maybe over time, if you throw in maintenance and all that, it's still cheaper than a human person. Would you still go out and replace your, you know, your regular cleaner?
So when you say a robot, you could mean perhaps one of those automated vacuum cleaners that go around this, or yeah, not like a cyborg.
Well, well, it would. So okay, so then you have to look at what a human can do versus a vacuum cleaner, right? So a human can hold a vacuum cleaner, so that would be a kind of that would be a smart plus analog kind of combination. But what if you got something that's robotic, you know, that does vacuuming, that's clean, that does in fact dust the fans, mm-hmm. and you could get that for cheap? And I think the issue is here is, do you still want those human relationships? Do you want to go down to the store, for instance, your sundry store, and pick out the milk, because you also get a chance to chat with the person there? Or you like the idea that maybe you're going to make different choices every time you go to the supermarket. It's not going to be the same one that you've had to punch in. And maybe the smart devices allow you that. I don't know. But anyway, we put out a poll, Melissa and Ibrahim, sitting there very quietly. And the poll reads, if you had a choice between a smart home, that's one that's connected, and one that is near analog, what would you choose? And we gave voters, there are already 11 votes that have come in, so please, you know, rush into our Twitter feed. It's pinned to the top of our
timeline,
mm-hmm. And it's 11 votes have come in. The options are completely smart plus analog, and completely analog.
So the majority seems to have picked a smart plus analog. What about you, Ibrahim? Which one would you choose?
My house is already smart.
Completely smart?
Not completely smart. The lock is still analog, but I'm trying to find solutions for that. And the solution is quite simple and it's quite cheap, where as I approach my door, because I have a beacon in my phone, in my pocket, which is my phone, by the way, the door unlocks by itself, and I don't need keys to access my house. So that's the only thing missing, in my opinion, for my house. But otherwise, you know, I can control my lights from my phone, and I can control my air conditioning from my phone. And that's the solutions are quite cheap. So I guess these are the kind of solutions for smart appliances and smart homes.
So there are people who are opting for smart plus analog. And I wonder whether that's a certain element of, you know, you don't fully trust that technology will hold up. Maybe technology might fail you. We've all been there where technology fails us.
What about the
us?
Security issues? So you have the beacon. Does every member of your family, Ibrahim, have a beacon?
No, okay. So that's the only thing missing in the setup of my smart home or my pursuit of having a smart home. But everybody should have a beacon because everybody in my household does have a phone. And for my baby, my 2-year-old and my 4-year-old, they don't have a beacon because they don't have a set of keys anymore. You know? So
probably
I guess,
can't reach the door yet.
They can't reach the door already. So, you know, in an analog setting, they don't have keys anyway.
Okay, so we have 17 votes at the moment. It now reads 18% for completely smart, 11%, oh, we've just gone up, 10% for analog and 70% for smart plus analog.
Yeah, so I've interviewed the large conglomerate firm Honeywell on the breakfast grill quite recently, actually. I think within this month or the month before this. And Honeywell is pivoting itself towards making smart buildings, not necessarily smart homes, but smart buildings. So in a facilities management setting, we have our superintendents or our, you know, building administrators, and they have, you know, the master key to everything to that building, right? Think of a big, tall, high-rise tower, office tower in KL, maybe 70 stories or 50 stories high, and they have access to everything. So what Honeywell is trying to do is make that building smarter. And this is basically giving the superintendents or the facilities management folks an iPad, and they can control everything from that building. So while it may be expensive in the short term, because of the efficiency that these smart buildings have, they might be able to push down costs going forward.
Well, I don't know. Okay, so when I look at the poll, I'm a bit torn between wanting to go completely smart and or go for smart plus analog. I think I'm leaning towards completely smart because I would want all that technology could give me for me to benefit from that and not worry about thinking about whether I have milk in the fridge or, you know, the cleaning of the house or when I need to change my bulbs. Smart lighting will do that for me. And that would give me time and, you know, the mental capacity to focus on the things in my life that I want to.
Absolutely. I think that's the plug that's made for making everything smart and connected. It is, you know, the promise of the Internet of Things. But I want to say here now that the polls got gathered pace, that there's something different between the office and the home, right? And I think the domestic sphere is a place where you might not want technology to be so all pervasive. Mm. I can see why, you know, in an office where you want efficiency is the kind of is prized and valued, it might not be so in the domestic sphere. But you're right. I can see the appeal, though. I'm kind of
so
tending
what about you?
Towards.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
you know, I don't think there's very much that's smart in my. Okay, so.
So would you go for completely analog?
I think I could survive completely analog. I think, you know, it was the case before. I can imagine a world without handphones or, you know, all those kinds of devices because I lived in such a world. I mean, I went to university with, you know, computers were quite primitive. They were still, you know, they were like those green script on that black screen. So, you know, and I remember how quickly technology changed and changed my world for the better. But at the same time, I can very easily imagine not living in that kind of world. So it's not unthinkable. It might be unthinkable for people of your generation, but certainly not mine.
Already, we have smart shops or retail shops where they have this thing called the iBeacon at these shops. And all you do is just walk towards the particular product and item, tap with your phone, and you're already connected with it. You've already bought it. You can collect it at the checkout counter or you can even send it at home. And a lot of retail shops are already doing this as we speak. But Malaysia has a big problem with pricing. And I think making our homes smarter would be a little bit more expensive than, say, in Singapore or elsewhere.
Well, but you know, as Sharad said, technology advances so very quickly, and with those advancements, the costs come down for sure. You know, I mean, it could not be unthinkable that our homes could be entirely connected within our lifetimes.
Okay, so the home has to be connected, the whole society has to be connected for these things to work, right? So your refrigerator says not enough milk, supermarket gets the message, a drone comes, picks up the milk and drops it off in your home
somewhere. Well, you know, it could be the little things, right? I would love for the coffee maker to turn itself on when I'm taking a when my alarm rings and I'm taking a shower and I come out and there's a steaming hot cup of coffee for me waiting.
But who cleans the beans out? I mean, the disgust. No, I mean, look, you know,
there's some things you just have to do yourself.
Yeah, I was reading in the papers how India has refused to allow its streets to be mapped for Google Street View because of security issues. Because the flip side to this interconnectivity or interconnectedness of our lives is also the possibility of breaches.
Yeah.
And I think that is a serious concern. And I'm not sure whether the payoff is so great at the end of the day.
Well, tell us what you think. You can try our Twitter poll. If you had a choice between a smart home, a connected one, or one that is near analog, which would you choose?
And what about the results so far? We have 26 votes, 19 for completely smart, 19 for completely analog, and 62, the vast majority.
Well, you've been making a good argument for completely analog because now from 0 to now 19.
Well, I don't know if I was one that persuaded everybody, but yeah, tell us and, you know, tweet us and tell us why you've chosen those options. And you can also read the Economist article. We sent out that link earlier.
Okay, it's time for the News Bulletin at 6:30 now with Nadia Aziz on BFM 89.9. Good morning. You're listening to The Morning Run with Sharad Kutan, Ibrahim Sani and me, Melissa Idris. That was Eric Clapton there with Crossroads. Good morning, 6:41 a.m. on Monday the 13th of June.
Yeah, so, you know, I there's a YouTube video on this song where Eric Clapton was jamming with B.B. King and John Mayer. That was fantastic. And I think that video was like 9 minutes and you just didn't realize it was 9 minutes. It's just, you know, you're rocking away.
Okay, like, so here's, if you had a choice between watching Eric Clapton live analog and watching it streamed smart, which would you choose?
I can't go to Louisville, Kentucky to see them jam, right?
Of course, live, for sure.
Have you seen Eric Clapton live?
No, I have not. I have
Melissa?
Not.
No.
Tim?
No.
No, I have.
Oh, there you go.
And I saw him live in Singapore. I also seen Ravi Shankar live twice. But with Eric Clapton, you know, he said at one point, because he didn't really talk to us, he said at one point, I would have played the song Cocaine, but I can't. And he kind of held up a letter that was like,
was that in Singapore?
Singapore.
Okay, well, the reason why we asked about analog / digital is because we were discussing earlier about smart homes. And we put out a poll, a Twitter poll, asking you if you had a choice between a smart home and one that is near analog, which would you choose? And we gave you three options: completely smart, smart plus analog, or completely analog.
And the results are, so far at 37 votes, we have 19% for completely smart, 22% for completely analog, and still reigning 59% smart plus analog, which is probably all the lives that, you know, the lives that we actually lead right now.
Okay. Well, Joe and Lee says that too much of the all smart lifestyle related horror thriller movies has made him skeptical to rely 100% on them. So I'm guessing, Joe, and you picked the smart plus analog option. I'm kind of leaning, I do agree with you, but I don't know. I'm leaning towards completely smart because I'd like to see what technology can give me in terms of freeing up my time.
Yeah, I like the idea of augmented reality. I mean, that's one thing that's quite quite seductive. And if you go to this, there's a brilliant little blog called buildingblog.blogspot.com, and building is BLDG. You'll have some of these videos that have, and that's when I first saw it, this kind of augmented reality where you can pull up information, as it were, in front of you.
I guess your Minority Report, Star Trek, you must be wearing one of those
goggles. Smart. But, you know, it could be very interesting. I mean, you know, information at the tip of your fingers. Like just now when I struggled to, you know, over Samad Ismail's name, I'm not quite sure how I would have found that, but I could have, maybe it could have anticipated what my brain was thinking.
Well, you know, Hazmal Fazni tried to help you out with his tweet. He mentioned it was Samad Ismail. Okay, well, in other news, we found a couple of other interesting articles this morning, and earlier this month, financial workers around the world set for one of three grueling stages of the Chartered Financial Analyst exam. So we thought we'll discuss professional certification and what it's worth.
You know, CFA is basically the most difficult to get the title. And the article that we saw was basically posing the toughest question by the CFA exam, which is, what's the payoff? Is it really worth it? Not a technical question like, you know, what's the present value of this particular company, but is it really worth it?
Well, okay, so no one's saying that it's worthless, but is it worth the investment that you put in? So test takers pour in more than 300 hours into studying for each level. They spend thousands of dollars on fees and materials to do it. What is the return on investment? Do you get a substantial increase in your pay? Do you get doors opened to you that previously were closed? What is the payoff?
Yeah, so the common urban legend has it that most job postings mentioning CFA would have a lot of money, you know, in terms of salary. But it turns out the survey that was done, it offers less than 100K per month in the US. So that's about 8,000 bucks per month. And, you know, and you spend close to 3 to 7 years of postgraduate studies to get these letters placed behind your name. And it's not just CFA, you're right, Melissa. It's about the ACCA, it's about the CIMA or CIMA, it's about CGMA, CPA, all these letters that follow after your name. The question is it really worth it? And for my argument, I guess not, you know, because you still can have a good job without these letters.
Okay, so the alphabet soup aside, aren't many of these certifications necessary for you to practice, you know, in your profession of choice? Isn't it like a foot in the door?
Yeah, it's a foot in the door, but not necessarily so, because sometimes you can still justify. Let's say if you want to become you know, a corporate finance person inside a big bank, you know, Maybank, CIMB, you know, and you don't have a CFA certification, what you can do is that you can justify your know-how and your knowledge. You know, having performed that same role in a different institution. So I guess it doesn't mean that you know, you're blocked out from a particular job just because you don't have the letters.
Well,
you can still enter that job market.
I want to hear from the HR managers. If they find that having a professional certification helps a candidate get through the door, perhaps gets a candidate noticed above others, or is it more of a signal? So you know how hard a CFA is. Perhaps it's a signal that if someone has passed it, it's a signal of a hard worker,
yeah,
a really diligent person, etc.
Yeah.
Right?
And of course that diligent person brings about that whole CFA notion, because there's three papers, and you know, most often than not, about 70 people fail the first paper, right? The first level. And I'm one of those guys, and I'm still on first paper, and I still haven't progressed.
Has that swayed the way you think about certification?
Of course, because you know, the pro of having the CFA is that it's a common standard to have. To pass a CFA means that you've earned your so-called rite of passage. But the con here is that it is a sacrifice to have that certification. A lot of money is spent, but more importantly, a lot of time is spent.
Well, let's hope it's not a con. Hiswani Hassan, who's a regular, good morning, Hiswani. You say that getting professional qualifications are not just about the technical stuff, but about what you become in getting that qualification. So your tardiness or your endless deferment of the moment, Ibrahim, is that good or bad?
Yeah, I'm a tardy person, and I believe the first to admit, right? But my question is it necessary for me to succeed? I'm not saying I'm a success, but what I'm trying to say is I'm not a failure either. And, you know, this is the whole idea of the certification.
So professional certification, you do concurrently with your job, right? So you don't take time out to do it. So you do it, you know, work and study. And anyone who's ever done that knows how hard it is to work and study at the same time. Boy, if you have a family as well, you know, juggling those balls is not easy.
Yep.
But I kind of wonder, I think for me personally, it signals to the kind of person that would pursue it, someone who's trying to better themselves, perhaps trying to increase their knowledge in an area that they've already decided will be their career. I want to know what happens to people who opt to take time out from work to pursue a certification. I know of people who have opted to do this and been punished because, you know, they have other people who stayed within their jobs who earn more because they're technically more senior.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I think there's another dimension to this, which is that, I believe completely in lifelong learning and continuing to pursue education. But what if it came without a certificate? I mean, what if you had nothing to show for that time spent and that investment in energy and reading and all that?
But and a skill and perhaps knowledge?
Yeah, skill, yeah, but without a certificate. Is the certificate something that is important to you?
The alphabet soup behind your name, you mean?
Yeah, the alphabet soup, the actual paper, the thing that you can put in your CV. I mean, you can always, because mention a course, but if it doesn't come with a certificate, I'm thinking about the way in which we've become society driven by the idea of accumulating certificates rather than talking about ourselves in terms of experience. So yeah, if you have that option, what does it change things for you?
I don't know.
Yeah, and but having said all that, while I gripe and moan about this whole nonsense, I still have that very notion of wanting to have a CFA after my name. So hopefully, when my kids are bigger, I can just pursue my paper two and paper three.
6:50 right now. Let's take a quick look at the Twitter poll that we've posted. 40 votes have come in so far, and a significant portion of that, 60%, have opted for a smart plus analog choice of a smart home. So a smart home with some analog options, right?
Yeah, and evenly split between completely smart and completely analog, 18% for completely smart, 22% for completely analog. I think the percentage points there are insignificant considering it's a small number at the moment of the poll. Please continue to give us your feedback in terms of the poll, the question that would come in, and we're going to be mentioning the results throughout the morning.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.